Summer heat turning you into a human sprinkler? Meet Sweat Block. Doctor created antiperspirants for excessive sweating and odor, made for the spots summer sweat hits hardest. Sweat Block helps you stay dry, comfortable, and confident with dermatologist recommended solutions backed by over 20,000 five-star reviews. Go to Sweat Block. That's SweatBlock.com. And take the quiz to find your best fit. Take the quick quiz at sweatblock.com and find the right fix for your worst summer sweat spots today. This summer, don't dress around sweat. Stop it with Sweat Block.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Prosecutors open against Lindsay Clancy by telling a Plymouth jury this case has nothing to do with postpartum psychosis and everything to do with a woman watching the clock, sitting there plotting, just somewhere out of nowhere decided, you know what, I just think I'm going to take out my family today and myself and what the hell. Nothing about the 13 meds, the waving her hands, going to hospital after hospital, provider after provider, saying, I need help. Prosecution doesn't, because that has to do with mental health. And since a lot of court systems, including Massachusetts, want to operate like it's 1898 instead of today, and they probably say, why don't you go check out leeching? See if leeching, ask your doctor if leeching is right for you. They want to basically railroad her and say that she's just a horrible person and none of the mental health stuff actually matters, which is really the whole crux of the damn case. We're going to be breaking this down today. The prosecution's opening statements, the defense's opening arguments, a little bit about what Patrick, dad, had to say here, the husband had to say, who still stands by his wife. And we welcome your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We're also going to be getting into, because we have to, Brian Koberger. And Lil Bri from behind bars is getting bored and wanted to raise his hand and say, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. And somehow think that him saying that means anything.
Any day we can torture him more is a great day.
Oh, my God.
So I'm all in.
Anytime a broomstick can enter one orifice and come out the other of him would be a great fucking day.
As Gonzalez says, the big D.
Yeah. The big D with a big B, a big broom right there. Don't even take the head off the broom. Just lay the whole fucking thing right through. Anyway, we're going to get into all of that. Your thoughts in the comment section as we work our way through all of this. Bob Mata was going to be with us, but it is summertime and he is on the road. So you got me and Robin today to break all this down. Robin, let's start with this. The state's timeline has her timing the drive to a restaurant. And they say they're trying to make a big deal. The family didn't normally get takeout from there. Well, big frickin' deal. I get takeout once a week, at least from one restaurant I've never used before. That's not that crazy. But according to them, well, that's a lot of that. That's something. And then sending the children's father out to get the food. The defense doesn't dispute any of it. The prosecution wants the jury to believe this is evidence she knew what she was doing. And hope they don't understand that people in psychosis can actively plan things. It doesn't mean they're sitting in the corner crying and rocking back and forth. Sometimes they are, but sometimes they can look just like you and me. How do you think this goes? There's a lot of understanding of mental health that's going to be required of 18 people. Do you think they'll get it?
No. I got to tell you, I watched the entire opening statements, prosecution, defense, and I didn't know anyone involved here except we've been covering Lindsay and the husband a little bit, obviously, in the coming, in the weeks prior to this. And I listened to the prosecution get up there, and she's making her statement. And Jennifer Sprague is the one that did it, I think, right? Or is it?
Yeah, it was Jennifer.
Yeah, so Jennifer gave the opening, and she did okay. You know, it was the typical what we expected, and, you know, trying to disparage her and say how premeditated it was and that you're going to hear this, this, and this. And it was everything I expected, no real earth-shattering things there. And as they're doing it, the camera kept panning to Lindsay and the lawyer, Kevin Reddington.
Yeah.
And first of all, I'm watching Lindsay, and her nonverbals were extremely congruent with someone who lives in a lot of guilt, a lot of remorse, a lot of, and without showmanship. I mean, so never once did she look up. I mean, think back to Donald Adelson. Every time Donna gave a tear, she's like, who's looking? No. Yeah. If you look at Lindsay's nonverbals, if you haven't had a chance to look at the opening statements, look at them, look at her completely collapsed in on herself.
Yeah.
It was all for her. Because she's uncontrollable, inconsolable as well, because of, she knew, very witting of the horrendous thing she went through and she did. And also what she knows is what she's about to go through and put everyone else through.
Yeah.
And then the master stood up. I was watching Kevin Reddington, didn't know anything about him before this. And I, from the outside appearance, I'm looking at what I thought was a curmudgeonly old man that kind of smirking a little bit when prosecution is going. I'm like, oh man, I don't know about this. And then he stood up.
It's Matt Locke.
Began speaking. Oh my God. He was all in. He completely eviscerated the opening statement of prosecution, in my opinion, without being mean, without doing anything. You could tell this 75-year-old defense attorney with amazing credentials. I was wondering, can he bring the energy? He's got the reps. Yes, yes, yes. He totally laid out. I mean, you could tell there's a connection that he had with her. He was like by her side in the hospital room trying to get access to her. He was masterful. He laid out exactly what he's going to do. He had the old time charts, you know, just holding up what things were. He had depth of field of everything coming out of his mouth. He was fluid. He was great. And so I thought in that opening statement, it laid out exactly what this case is going to be about. And he laid it out in such a way that, listen, here's what you don't know about psychosis. Here's what you're going to find out about psychosis. Because she was in psychosis. And to your opening point, I know, long narrative answer, because I was just so compelled by the test, by the opening statements, that when you do the research, and the prosecution was saying that, you know, she was pre-planned and all this, she didn't look deranged or whatever, you know, that you would think, you know, when you have a caricature in your mind of someone who's in a psychosis, you're thinking of something you've seen in the movies. That's not the way it works. Psychosis and hearing voices and being in that kind of state can be weeks and months and sometimes longer than that before you actually come out of it. So it's all everyday behavior with something on top of it. And that's what she had. That's what she's suffering because he's laying out the medication she's under. And again, that was just the opening statement. After the opening statement, it's like, hey, can we all vote now? I mean, it was really, really good. Anyway,
it was. And the thing is, in a trial like this, and by the way, Bob's in the chat.
Yep.
Because he's on the road. So Bob will be interacting with us that way today. We'll try and watch for some of your reactions there, Bob, and reiterate them into the conversation. The likability factor in this case is going to be important.
I thought it was going to be.
As much as anybody is like, well, it's not about that. You're right. There's so many things a trial is not about, but ultimately is, because you're dealing with human beings, and human beings are going to make decisions based on whatever speaks to them and comes across as authentic and true to them as possible. And I'll tell you what, my reaction after watching those opening statements from the prosecution felt like the shitty babysitter that you get as a child when the good one's not available. It's just where it's like, I have rules. I'm going to tell you what they are. They don't make a lot of sense. They don't necessarily conform to reality or how life is actually lived. But I'm going to tell you this, and you better think this or not think this. I really don't care that much. I'm not that convincing with my arguments, and I'm doing my job, and I'm getting a paycheck. That's what it felt like. It did not feel like a person that was convicted of anything they were saying out loud. Yeah. I don't know if she actually was or not. I didn't read to me like she was. But, you know, she's doing her job nonetheless, and this is the case that she's been assigned to handle. Then you get him up there and you get, you know, old school attorney. They don't make him like this anymore, guy.
No, thank
and
God
it was
him.
Like, holy shit. And it gave me a little bit of hope that maybe this won't be a hung jury. I do not think you get a guilty verdict on this. I don't know that you get a not guilty by reason of insanity, but I think you get a hung jury. At least that's where I've been saying from day one. But I tell you, I'm swaying a little bit more to maybe not guilty by reason of insanity, where she can go live the rest of her life in a mental health institution, which is what she wants to do.
Yeah. You know, and that goes to, I think, what we've been asking ourselves and covering all week on this And that is, you know, what's really justice here? You know, because the three young, beautiful lives are gone. Her life is ruined. Her ex-husband's life is ruined. Lives are ruined here. So what's really justice here? And I think once you saw Kevin Reddington get up there, I feel safe that justice will be done. And that is bringing attention to the mental health struggles that she went through and that a lot of people go through. I think he is going to do, because even just in the opening statement, he made a great argument again about what was going on with her medications, with her mental health. And so I think the real justice is here, like we said at the very beginning, you know, a couple episodes ago, was it'll be her getting the help that she needs and really a system getting a boost of understanding about the mental health struggles that women sometimes go through as postpartum and psychosis and all these things. So regardless of the outcome, because either way, she's behind bars the rest of her life, right?
Yeah. Robin, I mean, and look, and I don't know how many people are on the prosecution team, but the person who gave the opening statement.
Yeah, I was wrong on that. It was Shannon, not Jennifer.
Did it. I mean, you know, younger. I don't know how experienced she is. I'm not here to cast judgment, but you know, I'm going to guess 30s, 40s, somewhere in that vicinity, you know, has some experience here in life, like anybody of that age would. But then you get him. He's like, what, in his 70s?
75.
75.
And decorated.
And how, I guess my question is, how powerful is it to a jury? How powerful is it from one human to another when you have someone of a generation? Because let's be honest, that generation, they didn't have the mental health resources available to them that younger generations have had. Mm-hmm. And the effect of that is in bulk, in a larger number, a less of an understanding of mental health issues. I'm not saying it's anyone's fault. It's just generational. What you are brought up around, what you are educated and what you understand is what it is. But to have someone of that generation standing up and advocating for it, that stands out because you don't see a lot of it from that group for that reason. Again, not a disparagement, but it is what it is. So when you have someone of that generation who comes across as likable, who is educated, who has a good track record, who is decorated, all of that, that is advocating for someone much younger on a topic that typically that generation doesn't speak of that eloquently or with that much understanding, does that put a lot more weight on what he's delivering versus if there was a 35-year-old version of him delivering it?
Yeah, I think it's a part of it. He's got the reps, you know, and Shannon didn't have the reps. And that's okay because that's what life is. That's what gives it to you. And I know that the judge gave instructions at the beginning, you know, not to make it emotional. You got to go on facts and data. I know Bob and Bob's weighing in, you know, that's really important, but he also agrees that his opening was phenomenal. But here's a key takeaway for everyone absorbing this. It's a lot to your point there, Tony, but also on top of it, he looked like to me, he is a father taking care of his daughter who just went through this. I mean, that's the tenor he gave off. There was such a connection you felt between him and her about his caring and depth of field, about him taking care of her. And that just resonates so strong. And then when you actually do some research, first of all, when he says who's going to come up and speak on her behalf, we've covered this so often on so many cases. When you have a true nutter doing horrendous things, no one stands by them. Who came up and stood by Donna Adelson? Who came up and stood by the psycho mom who wrote about her, you know, husband being killed and you know, the children's book? Corey Richens, right?
Corey Richens, yeah.
Lori De Belvallo. Who could stood up behind these women? And to a lesser degree, but still an abuse side, you know, you have Ruby Frankie. You know, no one stands behind nutters. Who's standing behind Lindsay? Everyone.
Yeah,
absolutely. And on top of that, you just have this deep connection. The fact is, when you look it up, I said Kevin Reddington, this guy's really good. He is not court appointed. And apparently, the family, her parents, have gone completely broke paying for the defense of her, knowing she's still going to be behind bars no matter what. Again, people that have unhealthy relationships don't do these types of things. That's why the likelihood of psychosis and being under that kind of influence is much higher.
Well, the prosecution's whole theory is really just, it's bare bones. It's very simple. She didn't want to be a mom anymore, so she killed her kids. Okay, well, what basis do you have for
right, that? Right,
I'm
right.
waiting to see. We're going
like
to
work.
I mean, they have the floor right now, so we will see what they're going to bring out to back up that opinion. Right. We haven't seen it yet, so I'll give them that. But I mean, there has been nothing that's come out as of yet that really points to this being a case like that, where somebody's wanting to get out of a relationship and does all this sort of stuff. Well, the only reps we see here are a woman who has struggled begging healthcare providers for help to get her out of the nightmare in which her brain has been putting her in. That's it. We're not seeing the struggles or the let's escape attempts like we've seen in other cases, like Scott Peterson's or you name it, where Corey Richens, where they're looking for their off ramp. There's none of that here, but it's being pitched to us and to the jury as if this is that without the material, if you will. I mean, does that make it easier? I mean, because I think that in some ways that could be successful for a prosecution, because sometimes simpler is better. And then people don't have to think that deep. They don't have a whole lot to go. And if they just say, see, she did this because of that, how do you not see this? Some people are going to be like, yeah, that must be right. Because that's how a lot of people work. They're arguing about the voices that she heard, that she talked about. Oh, she only heard them once, and then it stopped. Okay, and yes, I don't think they're disputing that. Why are you telling us what that means? You're not a psychiatrist. You're not a psychologist. You're not one that can really interpret this. I mean, it's being interpreted by an attorney. That's why you have experts that come in and do this. An attorney, you know, is not going to be interpreting forensic DNA information, although they attempt to all the time, and then pitching it to the jury. But again, that's where the experts are going to come in. And I don't think they're going to find any experts on the prosecution side. They're going to be necessarily agreeing word for word with the simplistic explanation of what was going on in her mind, unless they find a really shitty expert witness to do so, which, I mean, they exist. So who knows? Who knows?
And Bob, you know, our great Bob Mott is agreeing too that you know, Kevin Reddington knows the case like the back of his hands. And you could see it in the first couple seconds there, just listening to his opening statement. It's the thing that really got me also, since you brought up the prosecution's opening statement, was, again, they're framing it as a murder-suicide attempt. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't fit the data of, again, I know that you can't really look as past as prologue with research, but when you're looking at the research, this is not the type of individual that does murder-suicide. And then if you just remove the suicide part of it, because, again, their claim in the opening statement was that she just didn't like the work. She just didn't want to be a mother. It was too much for her. But there's nothing that actually supports that, because the parents were there. She's getting help. She's getting all these things. Yeah. She loved doing these things. She's a real go-getter. And so if you didn't like being a mother so much that you kill your kids, where do you go from there?
So that's
why she committed suicide? Like you said, I think it looked to me, if you're looking behaviorally, like the prosecution got assigned this case, isn't emotionally invested nearly as much as Kevin Reddington is. And that goes a long way when you're presenting facts, data, and information to juries, I would think.
Bob says they misdiagnosed her initially when they failed to incorporate the fact that she had a manic episode after the birth of their second child. Yeah, they did. I think she's been misdiagnosed for a long time, and I think another piece of this that the prosecution, you know, is trying to lean into is, well, why didn't anybody do anything more? Well, we're learning they did a lot, and we're going to get it more into that. But there's certain reps that come, and I thought Patrick's testimony was very powerful yesterday. Just very matter of fact of, here's what I was thinking. He said years to digest this and be able to deliver this, you know, in a calm way to an audience, that, you know, the birth of their second child, she had postpartum depression. I mean, okay. And so when you've been through that hellstorm once, which in itself is a hellstorm. Mm-hmm. For the person who's experiencing it and the person and the people who are trying to care for that person. Don't wish it on my worst fucking enemy. And then she has another child, and the experiences seem somewhat reminiscent of the last time. You're not thinking that the person is going to go to quite that extreme. And maybe that's a failure of human beings and our brains and our minds of not thinking the worst could happen here, even though she said maybe the worst could happen here. But it is what it is. That's more of an that to me is more of an example and more of an understanding of what was going on here and why he would have gone out to get the food, because he wasn't thinking that she could possibly go to that sort of an extent. I know the prosecution is going to spin it a different way, but all these things they seem to try and spin on the prosecution, I feel like could very easily backfire under just the slightest bit of scrutiny. I think they really, if they want to win this case, they're really going to have to watch how they're throwing things out to this jury and just going, here's the facts, accept them. Because I think everything's going to be countered very eloquently by the defense of Lindsey Clancy.
Yeah, and I, what's important too, is I think people keep getting wrapped up. It's easy to get wrapped up because she's on the defense on this, is thinking that she's arguing for freedom.
Yeah.
No, it's completely admitting she did it. So we're really just talking about what the result of this trial is for her. So I just looked it up. So if Lindsey Clancy wins, not guilty by reason of lack of criminal responsibility, that's actually how the statute reads there. Massachusetts version of insanity defense, she does not go free and she does not receive a traditional criminal sentence. If the jury, so the initial commitment typically 6 months. So it's a long time still. That's why it's easy to get caught up with her. She didn't, not culpable of doing it. No, they totally accept responsibility for doing it. And the husband,
yeah,
too, is, I think what I found really interesting too, with the husband being divorced and having moved on, I thought about this. Does it actually help or hinder the credibility? I think it helps because he's moved on from her. There's no longer this marriage relationship, no longer necessarily standing by her side literally, but able to move on because he made a choice that he's going to move on with his life. But because of him knowing her so well, isn't resentful, isn't going to sink her boat, is trying to still get her the help that he thinks she needs as well. I think that says a lot. Like, he doesn't emotionally still connect it to her as a husband, but still able to stand by her saying it was more. I mean, can you imagine? You can imagine a scenario where someone moves on, gets married, divorces her, and eviscerates her, and stands by the prosecution saying that, you know, that she didn't do all this. She made it, was premeditated. She took advantage of me. She totally manipulated me to go out and get takeout, all these things. But he's not saying that. Yeah. So I think that says a lot as well.
I want to address a couple comments before we move on to the defense. This is a comment. I didn't like that she was the one who decided what medications to take and when. She didn't. She was prescribed medications. And then some, it is true that she did take some, maybe not directly as prescribed. She thought she knew better. Yes, that is a prime example of her brain not working well. Do you know the amount of like paranoia that goes on with this sort of disorder and psychosis and shit that goes along with it? It means you're not making educated decisions and your brain is telling you, I should do this, I shouldn't do this. That's why we have doctors. That's why we have providers. That's why you can't just go out to Walgreens and decide, I'm going to buy a bunch of SSRIs and antipsychotics and this or that, along with some Tic Tacs for fun. Because there's medical professionals who are supposed to know what the other hand is doing and administer it responsibly. And yes, people who get their medications prescribed in this sort of state are not exactly in the best state to know what to take or when to take them effectively or correctly. That's why she was misdiagnosed. She wasn't being treated effectively, and she should have never been in the position that she was because of all these misdiagnoses. So your argument there that, oh, she was doing this for that reason, is complete and utter fucking bullshit. You are actually reinforcing the counter argument with that sort of statement. I'm sorry. that's the fucking reality of it.
And a thing to keep in mind also, that's very hard, and I get it, it's very hard to understand what psychosis looks like if you've never been around it before. I haven't been around psychosis. I've been around people who have gone through withdrawal before, though. And when you go around people who are going through withdrawal and severe withdrawal, and you start seeing and hearing things because they're not actually there, here's what it looks like. And here's what people going through psychosis look like to others on the outside. Because you're looking for signs, because a lot of it was on the husband should have seen something, or she should have been aware of it. They look and interact with the world in a completely normal way. There's no deviation from the pattern. What happens is that voices get added in, visions get added in. And so what happens is it becomes, you have no idea. You have no idea that someone is in the middle of a psychosis potentially, just because, and that's why they're so rare. It's extremely rare. It's a very low percentage of people that actually have these type of postpartum psychosis. I mean, I think it's like 1% or 3%. I mean, it's very, very low.
It's
very
one
rare.
In a thousand.
But it is so undetectable by someone on the outside. And potentially someone from the inside as well, because as someone going through, I only have the reference of withdrawal, seeing someone, like I've listened to people tell me that they're hearing someone talking to them right now as they're completely interacting normal with the world, but they're hearing the voices. They're feeling people touch them. It's really some crazy, wacky shit. So as Bob says, let's wait and see the evidence come through.
When I see she's gaslighting y'all, bless your heart. Bless your heart that you've never had to be close to anything like this, that you have the gift of never being touched by this in a way that you were forced to understand, and you're able to live in such a world where this sort of thing doesn't exist. It does. I'm sorry to break it to you, but if you can stay in your bubble over there and enjoy the benefits of that, more power to you. But you don't need to insert your voice in places that you don't understand. Let's go on to the defense. Cora Clancy was named after the very first baby her mother ever delivered as a labor and delivery nurse. She was 5 years old when she died. Kevin Reddington walked into a Plymouth jury walked the jury through the last 5 months of Lindsay Clancy's life. Every prescription, every hospital, every phone call where somebody told her to stay the course. We're breaking down where this all goes from here. And we learned this yesterday too. I mean, again, this case is just, it's baffling to me. It is a prime example of someone who raised their hand and asked for help in every possible way. And the disease, the brain, whatever you want to call what was going on here, the postpartum psychosis ultimately won. But this is a person who was asking and begging for help, and she tried to get it, and it didn't work. By Thanksgiving, her parents actually moved up from Connecticut because she was rocking on the couch and banging her head into a pillow. Again, the burden of proof is on the prosecution to prove that she was completely mentally in a good place. She's rocking and banging her head into her pillow, and her parents have to move to help take care of their adult daughter along with her husband. Yep. Reddington says Patrick went to a doctor and told them they were turning his wife into a zombie. The state's going to tell the jury that she looked fine on January 24th. Fine compared to what? What are we comparing her to? She's fine. This is totally normal, healthy behavior. It's baffling. I mean, I don't understand how they're going to be arguing this.
I Bob hit it really well when he said Reddington's going to demonstrate what this context is. And this is why I feel really good about this. I'm sitting here catching myself, obviously my own emotional hijacking going, because I am compelled to lean towards her side of requiring more mental health care because of what she went through. Because the confirmation bias I had because of this is, I think, in there, although completely open. I can't wait to see what prosecution does. I'm glad they're up first. I'm glad we're going to see what their arguments are. I love taking in more information and data. But at the same time, though, here's where I feel really, really good. That context aspect of it. Patrick's given us context. Reddington knows the context after his opening statements, and also hearing from the great Bob Mata, who I have so much respect for, having listened to, and I'll give his plug out for the the John Wayne Gacy case. Holy cow, I'm almost done with the podcast on that. And just the work these defense lawyers, these great defense lawyers, and I'll have to caveat, great defense lawyers do to put, as Bob says, to put in the work. It's profound, it's humbling, it's inspiring, because at least in this case here, whatever the outcome is that the jury decides at the end of the day, I do have faith. I mean, off of just one data point of the opening statement, that Kevin Reddington will give the jury the context they need to make the right decision. And that's what the judge was saying too. And that's what Reddington said too. I know you're going to make the right decision. This is a lot of burden on you. They're going to see really horrendous things. People, I mean, I had to turn it off yesterday when Patrick started talking and they're bringing up photos already of describe your five-year-old. I'm like, oh my God, I can't watch this. This is rough stuff, but it's important stuff to bring the importance of mental health and what she went through here. And if ultimately the jury decides that it was a premeditated choice for some reason, then I feel good in knowing that they did all they could. As of right now, we'll see how it goes.
Patrick testified that she told him about intrusive thoughts of hurting the children about 2 months before they died. The state's answer is that 8 days before, she still felt fine enough to go skiing and leaving the two little ones at home with her. That's not really actually proof of much. It's proof nobody told him what he was living with and that he really couldn't quite identify. As much as the prosecution says this is not a referendum on women's health and mental health, and it 1,000% is.
Why wouldn't it be?
What I mean, I guess that's a bigger question we don't really have a great answer to in our society. When someone says something like this, and in this case, we're talking about a woman who's going through postpartum psychosis. I think Patrick and her were probably looking at it as postpartum depression. Very different. One's far more extreme. But if that's what you're thinking you're dealing with, the doctors are saying it's generalized anxiety disorder. It's actually bipolar one that she had. When you have this going on and you have someone that's having these sort of intrusive thoughts and they're saying them out loud to you, we don't have very good mechanisms on what to do with that human being for their own safety and well-being and the safety and well-being of others, because we don't talk about these things. We pretend they don't exist. I mean, half of our, the audience is like, well, she's just evil. This happens. People say these sort of things. And when you're the partner, the husband of someone who's saying that, or the wife of someone who's saying these sort of things, what do you do? I mean, yes, you can try and get them admitted. A lot of places will say, well, are they planning anything right now? If the answer is no, and they don't want to go in and they know the right words to say to not go in, that's not some sort of premeditated evil. That's the illness winning at that moment in time. What are you supposed to do? I mean, what is supposed to happen when the mother says these sort of things out loud? Because there's not really many levers that Patrick can pull that she already wasn't pulling to get help, that then kicked her out of the system or mismedicated her. We don't have many mechanisms in place when people go through these very real things, other than we just don't talk about them and pretend they don't happen.
Yeah, it goes to me. It goes back to that 1 in 1,000. You don't train for 1 in 1,000 all that often. And when you're trying to keep fixing things and it's disjointed, as we're seeing in the comments here, the medical professionals were not talking to each other like they should. They weren't decombobulating the soup of chemicals that she was on that they could put in her on. And when you are dealing with a 1 in 1,000 chances of something like this going on, what does someone like Lindsay and her husband and Patrick do? You defer to experts who supposedly are experts at telling you what to do.
Which they did.
Right. And they're doing that. And then it didn't work. And then nowhere in there did someone say, you got to get the kids out of there. No one said that, leave them with your parents. I mean, because they would have.
Maybe we need to do that in situations like this out of abundance of caution, because that's not the first lever anyone pulls. And it's not the first lever that I would expect Patrick to think of either. Again, because we don't tend to take crises. We don't see the level of crises in front of us until it's like, holy shit, it's there. And you're dealing with it at a level and you think it's being managed and you're trusting the people around you. Somebody asks, is it bipolar or is it postpartum? It's both. She was diagnosed with bipolar one. That's the ongoing, you got this. This is part of you type thing. On top of that, postpartum psychosis was going on after she had her baby. So postpartum psychosis is temporary. The bipolar one was misdiagnosed and was the underlying root of a lot of things. All of it not managed well, not diagnosed correctly.
And then also when you look at, when you take in the environment around you and you're making decisions based on the environment around you, which is your aesthetics, and Kevin Reddington's, you know, described what that house looked like. You have playrooms, you have cartoon images up on walls. I mean, it sounded like, as he's describing, a very loving, comforting house with young children in it. It's not like you have, you know, the friggin' Siders, you know, with 16 kids in squalor where you're like, oh my God, I got to save these kids. This is a conscious decision. We got to do something about this. This is, again, from the, our brains don't lock around the fact that something as horrendous could happen when it doesn't look like it could happen. When someone is performing exactly normal but has a psychosis, so something's being inserted. I mean, there's a lot of things that play into a decision-making process that it just, it is, it happens like this. Again, when you defer to the one in a thousand and your medical experts are saying everything's fine, just take these medications, and you're trying to do it on your own, and you're being as, I mean, from, again, we'll find out more from the prosecution, but from our optic, she was being as transparent as humanly possible. Here's what's going on here. Here's what's going on here. Anyway.
You know why?
You're killing yourself there, Tony.
Why I think the jury is going to be hung. Look at the chat. Because even with, like, you know, educated explanations, and here's what's going on, people still like to dig into where they like to dig into. And I mean, and everyone's titled their opinion. Like, that's totally
and
fine.
Good. But, and this is what we do. Critical thinking. Yeah. And that's great. That's why I love our audience. I love what we do, because this is about, all right, so if you don't think this, great. That's why let's watch a prosecution, listen, critically think through it. You know, I am still, as much as I'm on the women's health and mental health side of this, I am still going to keep taking in data. And I'll tell you what, there could be stuff that's presented. I might flip me completely around. We've done it on cases before. I'm willing to do it now. But that's why I'm also very happy that we at least have a defense attorney in here that's going to really give us some good data, I think, and good things to look at. And there you go.
I'm willing to hear what the prosecution has 100%. To say. As of yet, I haven't seen a whole lot that really changes my mind. Why am I passionate about defending this? Because I'm looking at, like, there's plenty of parents that are horrible that should hang for what they do to their children. This isn't one of them. Why? Because I look at every case differently. Not everything is black and white. Most things are not. And this one certainly is not. And if you're honestly looking at this thing, I don't see how anyone sees it many other ways. Again, unless, I mean, I could see a 19-year-old me having the exact opposite opinion on this case, because I have lack of reps in life experience and I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. And I have a strong opinion. Yeah, I could see another version of me who hasn't had life reps having a very different opinion. But once you have those reps on something like this, why am I so passionate about it? Because I've lived close to this.
Yeah,
and that's why I'm passionate about it.
I know.
Robin's had somebody who's close that's lived with this. That's why.
I love the high school friends that committed suicide to a psychosis. Like,
and anybody who's flippant about this hasn't.
Yep.
Period. Full stop. End of story. Bless your heart. I'm happy you haven't, and that you're able to not have it be that close and viscerally affecting you.
It blows your mind
when you see this.
When you see it, it completely blew my mind. We lost, my wife and I, because we went to high school together, lost a high school classmate who was valedictorian, went to a service academy, decorated officer, great mom, and lost her to this. Completely blew my mind. And that's when it really came home for me. And I know yours was even closer than that.
Because it does blow your mind, because you don't think people are capable of this sort of shit. You just don't, especially people that you trust, that you love, that have a total different history. They turn into a totally different human being. And you're like, I didn't know this was even possible. I thought this was in the movies.
Yep.
It happens. It happens. And bless your heart if you haven't experienced it. I hope you never do. I hope you never do.
And it was the same case of diagnosed, mismanaged with medical with medicines.
Yeah, and that's how so many of them are. So many. Well, they're doing this. No, they're not. And again, I can't fix that. I can't fix that lack of life experience. But all I can do is say
that's why this one we're going to take a tragedy. Yeah. And the justice here is let's get more. That's why, hey, great discussions, great arguments. Let's get more attention on it. Let's get better medications. Let's get better therapies. Let's get better attention so it doesn't happen again.
Exactly. Understand the failures and not just saying, well, it's not that. Well, it clearly is. It is clearly a big part of that. And that's why we talk about this. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. Let's go to another happy topic. A little comic relief here today. 13 months after Brian Koberger pled guilty to murdering four University of Idaho students, he's picked up the phone and said, it wasn't me. Really? Because I kind of caught you red-handed doing all the horrible shit. It wasn't me. And then you admitted it in court, and Olivia Gonzalez ate your fucking lunch. It wasn't me. That's what he's doing. He's raising his hand and saying, it wasn't me. Ooh, that's special. I'm not a killer. Are you an airplane tomorrow, Brian? Are you a dinosaur tomorrow? That's exciting. It's glad to see you're playing pretend and pretending you're things that you're not. He wrote a letter to the New York Times, or called the New York Times, a reporter who then decided this will be a good story for clicks, and decided to publish that Brian Koberger had called him and said, it wasn't me. Brian went to a thesaurus, used a whole bunch of big words that he thought made him sound smart, and then wrote a petition claiming that he should get a new trial.
Based on a BS book.
Based on a shitty book that we decided not to have the author on our show of because we started trying to read it. And like by over the weekend, we're like, can you read another chapter of this? Because I can't. So that happened. And it's kind of full stop. He doesn't really have a path for a new trial. I want to talk to Bob about this and see if there really truly is. I mean, technically, is there a path for anything in the legal system? Yes. There's usually some road that can change or thing that can happen. And, you know, anything is possible. And, you know, Santa might come down the chimney tonight, too. Is it likely? Probably not. But it's noise. And it's Brian Koberger who had admitted to it, and that's where it sat, that he admitted to it. Now he's saying, it wasn't me. Robin, are you surprised?
No, but I love every moment of it because it shows how much he's suffering. You know, I like that he didn't get the death penalty because he is suffering so much more behind bars. One of the things that he's arguing that what was the exact wording? He didn't get what he was promised or... because he's being tortured by fellow prisoners behind bars. Good. You know, you see that visceral response I get? This is scorn. This is so good. And the Gonzaleses came out with their statement that said, good, bring it, because now we can put the death penalty back on. I mean, just the fact that he's arguing this, and he's using the same verbiage that they had in, I don't even know that author's name that put out that trash, you know, saying that, it didn't go to trial because of mishandling or whatever the hell he's saying. We tried reading the book and it was just total bunk. His defense attorney, she did a great job. She did all she could. She saved his life, even though it really shouldn't have been. But Bob will be able to weigh in better than this, but this to me, it's just comical. Just comical because he doesn't have a leg to stand on. Even if he was to get some legs in this, he's his own attorney on this. Let's watch the show. I mean, it's just going to be, are you kidding me?
I mean, it is entertaining just to kind of watch. I'm trying to pull up the full text here because I want to read the appeal letter, which is funny. He wrote in by hand. He hand wrote this, and You know the joke where it's like you have the handwriting of a serial killer? He has the handwriting of a serial killer. And he did nothing to like squash that down at all. It's just like, oh, the serial killer is writing a letter saying it wasn't him in the handwriting of a serial killer. I mean, it just shows how ultimately dumb this guy is.
Yes.
And how he thinks he's such a deep thinker, and he thinks he's just so ironic, and he's just so this or that. And at the end of the day, what a buffoon he is.
You know,
just
the great
what an
research
utter fucking buffoon he is.
Yeah, the great research out there will tell you that it's never IQ that determines how successful you are in your life. It's always EQ, the emotional intelligence. And without fail, every single case we cover, the level of emotional intelligence of these abhorrent buckets of genetic goo is zero. And every time you have someone like Koberger trying to write, because everyone say, well, if they're so stupid, how come they get away with these things sometimes? Well, it's because you have bungling idiots sometimes that do things wrong, or they just happen to dumb luck themselves into it. But the thing that always trips people up on these things is their low emotional intelligence, because they see themselves as victims, they see themselves as wound collectors, and they're going to get retribution, and they have zero emotional intelligence. They don't know themselves, they don't know others, they can't problem solve, and they get emotionally hijacked. They're completely idiots. And so when guys like Koberger start spewing stuff, sit back and watch a show of someone that has zero ability to interact. Plus, on top of that, very clearly undiagnosed by me because I'm not a licensed clinician, but very, very clearly high on psychopathy.
1,000%. Can I pull this up? I want to, I'm going to see if I can show you over here. People has published the...
Yeah, no, Bob's dying that he can't be on with us right now.
So, I mean, this is the writing of what it looks like. I mean, the writing of a serial killer or a third grader. One of the two.
Still,
and he's not in third grade, so I think we know what's going on here. I'm going to read it because it's story time.
Yeah.
I wish we had like some story time music or something. Do we have anything like?
Oh, did you hear? Oh, I'm sorry. You and I watched Clarkson's Farm. Little digress for everyone. And what do the Irish do? Yeah, yeah. I just give you yeah.
Yeah, I wish we... Do we have... We'll go with this. Okay.
It's not bad.
Yeah.
Here we go. It is hereby declared... I should start... Okay, so this is his handwriting. Brian C. Koberger, he wrote in the... being first duly sworn on oath, deposes and says, and here's where he fills in those blanks. It is hereby declared that during attorney-client discussions, most of within included all members of Brian C. Koberger's immediate family, which is interesting to note, and I'll say this to the Brian C. Koberger family, now's the time to declare your allegiance. Are you on Brian's side, or are you on the side of the victims? Because I'm going to tell you this, he's calling you out, and he's saying that you're on his side. And I'll tell you what, if you are, and he's going to start using you as like name pieces, you better declare your side. Because if you are on his side, okay, you are now open game as well for us to discuss and dig into what exactly made this little fucking evil monster that is Brian Koberger. We haven't touched any of you because we feel horrible. I can't believe going through this. But if you're going to dig in deeper and think little Bri couldn't have done this, we'll find out exactly what made this shit show. So... I think it's time to say what you believe.
And it'll be also interesting to see if his parents now foot the bill for actually paying for a lawyer for him.
Because there's fucking questions.
Oh my God. Thankfully, we can finally put this horrendous chapter in life behind us. And he brought it up again. They got to do it again.
Like, it's time to call out Lil Bri and put him to task for what he did. And if you don't believe me, there's questions. Looking at janitor dad bumbling around the yard doesn't look like the finest specimen of human DNA, in my opinion. So I'm wondering what the fuck's going on there. And I question a lot of what's going on there. But I digress.
Yeah, Brent Turvey, that's the guy. Yeah.
I digress. I do question what the fuck. But anyhow, let's go back to Lil Bri's letter, who's claiming that you're standing by his side like Sade. Continuing on, a petitioner was convinced to falsely confess to capital murder and felony burglary by coercion, disinformation, false promises, and the withholding of exculpatory discovery. The following is material to the inception of the plea. One, counsel's failure to inform petitioner of exculpatory discovery received during plea discussions, namely clumps of unknown hair found in Ethan Chapin's hands, as well as the failure of further inquiry. Two, petitioner was convinced that actual guilt was not an important factor in considering plea acceptance. Well, I can't help you're an idiot, Brian. That's kind of like what that is. Death row was imminent and advised to lie. Petitioner was given a legal victory in entering a false plea. A gross misrepresentation of and promises regarding what a life sentence would immediately afford petitioner, and a gross misrepresentation of death row in Idaho, including an elaborate fabricated story of counsel's horrific experiences touring an actual 6x8 death, that's the end of first page, row cell, all communicated to petitioner as his and his family, allegedly by IDOC through counsel, thus constituting threats and promises made to incite, I think it's supposed to say, or endure, incite, I can't tell what the fuck he wrote, a plea agreement. Signed, Brian C. Koberger.
Basically saying that he was promised life in prison was better than this.
Basically. They said there was going to be cookies.
Oh, God. The fact he wrote this, you know, so here's what's really great. Thank God for that moron that wrote that horrible book, because without that book, Koberger would not have done this and brought us such great entertainment. So we wouldn't see him suffering so much.
I needed a laugh.
I'm not a human being that likes watching other human beings suffer, but this is one, because he's not a human being. Again, abhorrent bucket of genetic goo.
I needed a good laugh today.
I hope we get more. I mean, it's not going to get another trial. Obviously, Bob's very vehement on as well. But I really hope that we get a little bit more entertainment out of watching him suffer a little bit.
I mean, again, I mean, I Bob, you need to be here because I got questions for you.
his messages are great on the chat.
I know. He says it's killing me. But I mean. Okay, Bob, I'm just going to ask you in chat. You tell me. I mean, is there any iota of where of this could possibly go anywhere? I mean, if he can back up some of these claims that he was bamboozled into accepting this agreement and told that there was, I mean it reads pretty shittily. I mean, but is there any ground, I guess, for any of this? I mean, an attorney at some point, and Ann Taylor did her job, in my view. I mean, she stood by him and tried to find every possible road that could go down, and at the end of the day, knew there was no road to go down.
And I tell you what, until I listened to Kevin Reddington, she was up there. You know, Kevin Reddington, yeah. You know, you got Bob Mata, Kevin Reddington, and Ann Taylor, the top three we've seen in the last couple of years, right?
It's just, is there any scintilla of possibility that this does go anywhere? I mean, is there anything... The very strong defense that Ann Taylor put up for Brian Koberger, is there any judge in the world that looks at that and says, yeah, you weren't served by your public defender and you deserve a second chance? And the fact that Koberger is basically asking to have the death penalty like put back up and try me for that. I mean, does this go anywhere? Is this just some moron grandstanding from his cell because he was bored on a Tuesday and everybody needed some content?
Or you want the better bananas.
Brian, you picked a wrong week to do this because there's a lot of shit going on. You should have done this a couple weeks ago where it was more quiet. You would have gotten a lot more attention than what you're getting on this. But I just don't see it going anywhere. No. His argument is bad counsel. So there's a named attorney who spent 2 years on this case, you know, has her reputation riding on an accusation that she can't answer. Her office declined to comment. She's gagged by her own ethics rules while he talks to the New York Times. I'm wondering, again, good question for Bob, too, is Ann Taylor gagged by those ethics rules now that the client is out there saying that he didn't have adequate counsel. Can she now? I'd love to hear her story. I'd love to hear what the hell she thought was going on. If she's no longer counsel, is she still bound by those rules? I don't know the answer to that question.
I think she's too professional, but we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I do too.
And someone asked, might ask Mr. Drieg, why are they not trying to work with Coburg behind, you know, kind of like what they have the deal with like BAU and stuff, I'm guessing is what that kind of question is. Maybe. Yeah. So here, I know that Rex Heuermann made the deal to talk to BAU, part of his plea agreement. Understand this though, professors like Ramsland, which was his professor, as well as the BAU people, everyone on the face of the planet will try to attempt to interview him to gain knowledge for future cases, so you can create profiles and expand our knowledge base for really broken-brained individuals. But it really is up to them whether they accept that or not. Rex Heuermann was part of that thing. Someone like Koberger, believe it or not, would love the ability to do that, because it gives their ability to relive it. It gives a notoriety. It puts the attention on them. I'd be curious whether they actually haven't had an interaction with him already. They may have. If not, they'll definitely be trying if they haven't already. But there's a long list of really broken brain individuals out there that I guarantee they've already talked to and will continue to talk to.
I mean, is this because number one, does it matter why he did this? I mean, at the end of the day, it's going to be some discombobulated cognitive fucked up distortion in his brain of why it was justified, or why, some woman looked at him the wrong way in his little incel brain and he got his feelings hurt and his tiny penis didn't do anything. You know, all of the shit that makes him who he is, the pathetic blob of human DNA that is Brian Koberger. But does anything here, I mean, is this a good thing that he seems to be stirring behind bars? Does that mean that maybe at some point he'll get bored enough and start telling us more about why he did this? But at the end of the day, like I said, even if he does it even matter? I mean, does whatever equation in his mind that he came up with that ended like this, does it matter? Especially if he's saying he didn't do it.
So here's an interesting thing with that. So let's look at what he actually has for currency, kind of like Rex Heuermann. The only thing that Rex Heuermann and serial killers have after the fact is knowledge. Information is their currency. And there's a lot of things that people would like some answers to, like where'd you put the knife? Lestat, because I've always theorized, because he studied past serial killers, that he probably secreted all the things he used and stashed it someplace that we don't know.
Yeah.
Getting that kind of information would be good to do. And so as he's getting desperate for interaction and for things, that becomes a leverage point against him, where it's like, hey, Koberger, you give us this and maybe we'll give you a little bit of attention today. And you start. So the fact that he's getting desperate for interaction, desperate for better bananas, whatever it is, it gives the government and profilers and all the other people leverage against him, because he ain't going anywhere. Give me a break.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
you give a broken brain like that a little bit of hope, and we actually might get a little bit of leakage over time on this one.
I mean, it's kind of Mindhunter-ish, where you get the that crew in there, the behavioral analysis crew, that can start asking some questions and examining, like Heuermann, or like they did Kemper, or like they did, you name it. This seems to be a bit of a tell that he's getting restless.
He's always been full of rage. I mean, just look at this. Rage becomes our lever of influence over him, because he's uncontrollable in his rage. And when you look at people like BTK, and you look at people like Rex Heuermann and all these other serial killers, they seemingly have the ability to maintain calm, just that stoic, no reaction, just because they're emotionless, because there's nothing in there. But Koberger, and they all have that side of sadistic rage and all those things that we know about, but Koberger has a lack of ability to seemingly control it. He's very, very emotionally reactive, and that becomes a very, very powerful thing they can use against him when it comes to interviewing.
It's going to be fascinating.
So what's Bob say?
What did Bob say? His only two avenues are, my lawyer did not provide me all the potential exculpatory evidence, so my plea was uninformed. It's going nowhere. Okay. Well, yeah. What about that? Yeah. What about the hair thing, though? I mean, what that is, that's not necessarily, would that be considered exculpatory? We got to have this as a one-on-one conversation. we'll do that next week.
Here's what I say, Koberger, try. Keep trying, man. You're making a great show. You're showing us how angry, and because every time he tries and doesn't get his way, what happens? He gets angrier. When he gets angrier, what happens?
Comedy
leakage,
gold.
Comedy gold and leakage. When people get angry and emotionally hijacked, they leak information. That is the easiest way to get intelligence.
It's going to be interesting. I don't know if he does anything else.
He's suffering, which is great.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that I think is the biggest tell out of all this. He's not having a good time.
No.
He's feeling he was betrayed and people lied to him, or that jail isn't as hunky-dory as he thought it was going to be when he decided to get his ticket punched and go on this ride. Sorry, it's not everything. It was cracked up to be, Bri.
I don't think anyone would ever believe that Ann Taylor sold him out.
No. Oh, my God, no. Oh, God. All right.
We were worried many times that Ann Taylor was doing too good of a job.
Honestly, yeah. I mean, and sorry, Brian. You made your decisions, and now you got to live with them.
Tweet your rotten bananas.
That's a shame. Look out for those broomsticks. All right. That's going to wrap up today's conversation. Weigh in. Give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue our conversation right there. Until next time, for Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.